This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District. With new commercial construction, more than 350 acres of green space, parks, and sports complex. More information at nnmd.org. Grow near.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout, doing our favorite thing, which is talking politics. And as always, we've got a lot going on, both nationally, internationally, and of course, here in the great state of Texas. Brandon, we had a summit. It finally happened. start, stop. But we actually had the Donald Trump King Jong-un summit. What happened there?
Yeah, I think, it depends on who you ask and how you look at it. Either a lot happened or nothing happened, right? I think a lot of people look at this as being similar to what happened in 1994, where kind of a broad goals were outlined, but not much actually got done once you get into specifics about exactly how denuclearization will take place. But for me, this was a qualified victory for the president, right? You were able to kind of show you can act on the international stage with all the caveats that, you know, North Korea is not a good regime in any case, but he made it look interesting. He made it exciting. He made it TV ready, for the lack of way of putting it. And although nothing may come of it the same way it did for President Clinton, it shows that you can be on the international stage. What was your take? Do you think this is a step towards broader peace, or is this just political theater?
Yeah, I just think it's just political theater. I mean, essentially the deal they got, as you said, is the same thing they had in 93, 94. Mm-hmm. There's nothing new here. It's very, very general. If anything, I think the argument can be made that North Korea was the big winner. They got to they got to stand on the same stage as the President of the United States. There's that really somewhat surreal picture of the North Korean flags and the American flags lined up next to each other. So in terms of sort of substantively, I don't think there was anything that came out of it. What the North Koreans got was not just the summit with the president, but they got a halt and cessation of joint military action between the U.S. and South Korea, something that the North Koreans have wanted for a while.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure what the Americans got out of it right now, but you know, I think we can be optimistic and hopeful that moving forward, that you'll see some positive things. Now, this came on the heels of a pretty contentious G7 summit that took place, right? The Group of Seven Nations. And the president had some pretty harsh words to say, Brandon.
It was an unusual, like, 36 hours spent in Quebec. The president on these kinds of issues tends to be kind of go with the flow. There tends to be a kind of meeting of the minds for these countries. But President Trump was a bit of a fly in the ointment. He had proposed a number of things, including letting Russia back in the G7. They had been kicked out after they invaded the Ukraine and attempted to annex Crimea. He also, said some fairly, I don't know, ugly things about the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada. They were, prior to that, basically, bromigos, right? They were together on most things and had meetings which reflected the kind of strong commitment that the U.S. and Canada have to each other. But he had indicated in a tweet that he thought that Trudeau was weak and was being dishonest and weak about issues on tariffs. I think it's just another example of the kind of unforced error that the White House doesn't need to accomplish. And these are the kind of moments that you want to be a shining star. And the White House had the chance to do that, and I think kind of failed.
Yeah, I think initially the president had indicated he would sign on to the G7, the joint communique that they put out. And then he pulled back on the plane as he was watching and listening to Prime Minister Trudeau's speech. I think the idea that the two of them had a close relationship is probably not accurate. Mm. It's interesting. The Canadian media really reports that in many ways that Trump sees Trudeau as an Obama-like figure, sort of the opposite of what he normally likes. Mm. And so as a consequence, has lashed out on him. And it's ironic that he heaped praise on Kim Jong-un and went after Justin Trudeau, which is a little bit odd in itself. But I'm not sure if this is anything more than the way Donald Trump sees this as a larger negotiating ploy. We're still in the middle of negotiations on NAFTA. I think he's trying to wrench out the best deal possible. And he also, I think Larry Kudlow, the chief economic advisor, made this point. He's trying to demonstrate that he is a strong leader sort of in the lead up to the summit. So I think all this kind of going together, this is, again, more theater than substance.
Yeah, strength is not always the same as force. And I think the president kind of conflates that on these kinds of international bargains. So we'll see what comes of it. If anything, it could just be that a lot of these leaders are simply ignoring what he's up to, and maybe it doesn't have any effect, but this can't continue for too long before they start to push back too.
Brandon, net neutrality, the idea that we can have unfettered access to the internet, that private companies aren't able to change speeds as they see fit, ended as we know it. Big change in the telecom world. What's going to happen going forward?
Yeah, I think that the thing that most people fear will happen is that there'll be fast lanes and slow lanes, and that these providers will be able to identify those and prioritize some and deprioritize others, and some are going to cost you, some are going to cost you less. So I think that that's the real kind of change. And because the internet has become so kind of fundamental to our lives and our work, that this is something I think it could be fairly disruptive to most people.
Yeah, I think the next step to me is when we move to the next generation in terms of speed, if we're going to start to see some changes. I would be shocked if we saw internet providers suddenly throttling down and up speeds, at least within the next 24, 48 hours. But I think over time you might see some issues develop. And it'll be interesting to see if we see the development of new content providers or whether or not they're going to have any challenges moving forward.
Yeah. Hey, as long as the podcast, you know, streams effectively, right, we're good, right? This is
exactly
where you learn about the political world and the future. Right?
Just don't throttle up and down party politics and you'll be good.
Right. Hey, speaking of throttling down, the Supreme Court handed down a pretty interesting ruling with respect to whether or not states can purge and in what way they can do so. What happened?
So the state of Ohio for many years has had a law in place that stated that if you did not vote in three previous elections, you were potentially subject to being purged. They would send you notification asking if you wanted to continue to be registered. And if you did not respond, then as a consequence, it would remove you from the voter rolls. Now, the consequence of this could be pretty significant, particularly in states with low participation rates. Here in Texas, we only vote about half the folks that are registered on any given election. We've had elections in some cases where, you know, 15%, 20%, you see that a lot at the local level. So the danger is that a whole bunch of folks are going to get removed off the voter rolls. We know that you have the process of re-registering kind of can sometimes be cumbersome and make people not want to vote. I think this is a long going forward could have some long-term ramifications in terms of voter participation.
Yeah, and Ohio is a battleground state, so there are definitely national implications to this. Texas follows a similar procedure to Ohio, like you said. So although it's slightly different, you can be purged from the list if you don't vote after they've sent you a specific renewal notice. As of March in the primary, there were about 2.1 million registered voters who are on the suspense list, which means if they don't vote, then they're going to get kicked off. This is a pretty big chunk of Texans when you consider how large the state is and frankly how few people actually come vote. So this could be problematic for a state like Texas that basically certifies their ability to do this and probably puts a pin in a lot of the momentum towards having like an online registration or changing the way people stay on the list after they don't vote for a period of time. Well, Jay, speaking of purges, it looks like the White House is again continuing to purge staff. What's going on?
Yeah, it looks like the LinkedIn resume building sites out there are going to be working overtime for the communications department.
Yeah.
But apparently, White House spokesperson, chief spokesperson Sarah Sanders, and deputy press secretary Rod Shaw are looking to exit at the end of the year. That is coming from reports from CBS News. It's not confirmed yet, but it seems to be an ongoing conversation.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at probably a changeover at the end of the calendar year, maybe after the midterm elections. A pretty big change for a communications department at a White House that has had and seen massive turnover.
For the kind of job that a press secretary has to do, I think she's done an adequate job. There have definitely been controversies, but the role is not easy to begin with. And when you've got Donald Trump as president, it makes it even more difficult. So I think that the fact that she lasted as long as she did is pretty surprising. The cratering of their staff, I think, is really problematic, especially as you note, it's going to come right after the elections where there's a good chance that the Republicans could lose the House, which is the best moment that the White House can have to regroup and reassess where they are politically. That is really where some presidents have shown when they've gotten in that political position. Will the White House be able to handle it without a kind of solid staff? It's going to be more challenging.
I think the larger issue for me, Brandon, is that the constant leaking coming out of the White House really hurts them. This is something that's 6 months in advance, and you get sort of tepid denials, you know, no decisions have been made yet.
Yeah.
It works against a White House that's trying to have some level of discipline in terms of message.
Yeah.
And again, it just sort of reinforces that they're in somewhat of disarray.
And this is a temporary position. I mean, the average is like about 2+ years. In fact, I looked this up, the shortest tenure of any White House press secretary with Jonathan Daniels for FDR. He was in office for 19 days.
Well, let's remember the communications director of this White House was one.
Yeah. Before Scaramucci. Right?
Exactly. The Scaramucci, the mooch.
The mooch.
The mooch.
How can we not talk more about the mooch? I think that definitely needs to be on our agenda, like weekly, right?
Yeah, I know.
Well, he was on with Stormy Daniels' attorney, right, on some talk show, right?
So yeah, the desperation for 15 minutes of fame on all sides of that is getting
how far
greater.
Can you stretch that 15 minutes, right?
Exactly. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit of Lone Star State politics here in Texas. The Senate Texas School Safety Committee has held some hearings to try to determine some solutions or suggestions about what can be done in the aftermath of Santa Fe. Brandon, what have they been talking about?
So far, it's been fairly narrow. Most of the conversation was about having armed marshals in schools and whether or not it was permissible to allow faculty and staff to carry firearms. That was what most of the conversation was about in this particular hearing. To me, this is an ongoing question, and we'll, I think, probably circle around who's going to pay for all of this. Marshals are expensive. You have to have considerable training, something like 80 hours of training in addition to psychological exams. That's a lot of effort and a lot of time for many school districts who don't have the resources to be able to accomplish that. So there are still, I think, more questions than answers. But again, the fact that the governor is putting this on the agenda is something that is, I think, probably politically good for him. And it could be that there's some breakthrough that can be had on the issue.
Yeah, to me, this is nothing more than, I think, highlighting the urban, rural, suburban divide. Mm-hmm. Rural communities have had this option. Rural districts have had this option for a while. It makes sense there, less so in suburbs. And I don't think it makes any sense in urban communities.
Yeah.
It also speaks, I think, to this issue of local control. None of the superintendents and school boards and many of these districts want this to happen. So it'll be interesting to see moving forward whether or not they want to essentially sort of make this a state function rather than one that's a local function.
Yeah. Well, speaking of states, the statewide offices are up, right? We've got a U.S. Senate race. We've got all of the statewide executive officials. But it turns out that maybe it's the case that the third party, an independent group, will try to crash the U.S. Senate race. Jay, what's going on
That's
there?
Right. The so-called Indy Party, and I used party in quotes because it's not actually
a party. Right.
It's a for-profit corporation, kind of an interesting scheme cooked up by a bunch of investors to try to get on the ballot in this U.S. Senate race. But it's unclear what the A stand for and B, what the intentions are in doing this.
You know, if you watch the video from this Jonathan Jenkins, who's this self-styled tech entrepreneur, and he's from ULIS, it's actually fairly compelling. It's clever. It's personal. I think that one could probably develop a kind of agenda around this. But you're right. There's not much of a political agenda except just that the Republicans and Democrats aren't doing well. They're going to have to get 47,000 signatures to be able to get on the ballot. That is harder than it sounds. And so I don't suspect we're going to see this going too far. But the fact that there's this kind of for-profit corporation that's backing this with this cryptocurrency, to me, is a kind of tip of the spear when it comes to how campaigns are funded and what campaigns really are. So it's a little worrisome, in fact. And so, not surprisingly, you've had both parties who have pushed back on this.
Yeah, especially when you think about the fact that, you know, we have a pretty regulated system when it comes to our election process. And essentially, they're trying to upend the entire model. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of how we adjust or how the government adjusts and frankly, how the political parties adjust to this.
Well, speaking of adjusting, there are lots of students across the state, Jay, about 100,000 of them, who have had glitches in our famed and much beloved STAR test, the State of Texas Assessment of Academic Readiness. What is happening?
Yeah, once again, we've had massive problems from now our third different vendor for the STAR exam.
Yes.
Essentially, what was happening is that many students took the exam, they submitted it. There was already issues related to a delay in computers being accessible. Students were sort of knocked out. But all of a sudden, a bunch of students received zeros on their scoring. About 100,000 scores were invalidated as a result. Lots of technical problems. Sort of an annual problem. Again, it sort of reinforces that nobody likes STAR. Nobody thinks it's a particularly good test. But yet we continue to do it when there are better alternatives out there.
I'm getting test anxiety just thinking about it, Jay, right? Yeah. The number of glitches and, frankly, the scale of these glitches is really problematic, right? So why they can't get this sorted, I don't know. But if they're going to insist on doing these tests, they have to be able to sort this out. And frankly, as you said, there have been years of these kinds of issues. So maybe Mike Morath, who's fairly new, right, only about a year in office, will be able to do something about this. But as it is now, there's just too many issues to be able to rely on these tests for the reasons that and the for the factors that we tend to rely on them for.
Well, Brandon, we know that Texas has been sort of ground zero when it comes to dealing with the immigration crisis of unaccompanied minors crossing the border or just being here. Mm-hmm. The federal government is floating a proposal to essentially house in what they describe as tent cities for undocumented and unaccompanied minors. It's raised all sorts of concerns, just, I think, basic human rights concerns of the way you're treating essentially children. Hugely problematic. A lot of protests have already broken out. We're not sure if this is going to move forward, but it's a pretty significant issue.
Yeah, this is something that the state has had been the use of military bases to house individuals temporarily, especially children, as they've come over the border unaccompanied by an adult. But I think the optics of this are really bad. To me, if any of these elections are fought over immigration, the Republicans have an advantage. But I don't know that that's going to be stable if this keeps up, right? There is, as you said, a kind of moral tone to this that I think gives an edge to Democrats. And these kind of tent cities remind me of the Hoovervilles, right, in the 1920s and 1930s, where people would just kind of camp out and it was just this despair that was manifest in this little village of people living in these tents. So it feels wrong, and I think that the Trump administration is probably going to have a political issue on their hands, and that's going to trickle down to the Republicans in Texas who are going to try to run on being tough on immigration.
Yeah, I think the other problem with this is that the number of actual unaccompanied minors has dropped dramatically over the last year. And so part of this issue is that this is a self-created problem because of a current policy that says we're going to separate children from their parents. So essentially what they're talking about is creating a whole bunch of unaccompanied minors, housing them in these temporary facilities that people are, as you say, as you describe, sort of Hoovervilles or the equivalent thereof. The optics are bad, the politics are bad. And I think from a moral perspective, I think this could turn on Republicans badly.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Republicans and entering a building as opposed to being outside of a building, we've got an interesting round ball tournament that's coming up here, Jay. Jimmy versus Ted.
Jimmy versus Ted. Well, Jimmy Kimmel, the late night host on ABC, had challenged Ted Cruz, the junior senator from Texas, to a one-on-one game of basketball. They were raising money for charity. There's a couple of things going on. It's happening here in Houston, Texas. We're excited about that. There's some politics at play here. Ted Cruz famously is unliked, but is trying to get people to like him more. Jimmy Kimmel is a popular late night talk show host, and this kind of self-deprecating stuff can be very positive for candidates.
Yeah.
But sounds to me, you know, I think there's some Democrats that are a little upset because this is like a big Ted Cruz commercial that could be going on.
Yeah, it's here in Houston for one. I thought that was actually surprising and frankly a pretty big coup for the Cruz campaign. It also, I think, like you say, allows Ted Cruz to be able to demonstrate that he can be, you know, fun and engaging,
I'll
too,
tell
right?
you it would be fun. Yeah. At the 11th hour, Jimmy Kimmel sprains an ankle and says, hey, I've got a guy named Beto O'Rourke, and he is going to play that game.
I thought you were going to say, like, it's LeBron James, right?
Yeah, yeah. But it would be kind of funny, at least even it out on the politics side.
But I think that Ted Cruz is able to turn lemons into limoncello here, right? I mean, he's got high enough negatives that he's got to do something to turn that around. This is really an opportunity to do that. And so it's frankly something that's going to get national attention too. He demurred when asked recently whether or not he would run for president again. I think there's a pretty good likelihood he will. He wants to keep those national ambitions alive. He's, of course, got to get reelected to be able to make that a platform and to jump from there. But this is the kind of thing that politically, at least, is controversial, but I think definitely is going to pay off for him.
Well, speaking of the round ball, we got a different kind of round ball.
The one we kick, not the
That's
one we bounce.
That's right. I know you are not a soccer aficionado, but the other football is coming potentially to Texas, the United States, Mexico, and Canada, sort of a North American alliance, will be hosting the 2026 World Cup. There's a good chance that Houston, Dallas, or maybe both, will be one of the host cities. Pretty exciting stuff.
Hey, we were talking about this earlier. Yeah, I'm gonna try to catch the fever. I'm gonna have you teach me all the ins and outs of soccer. I am a tennis fan, and so I am also a victim of kind of non-popular U.S. sports, right? So I think that tennis and soccer are probably the two biggest international sports, and yet doesn't get as much love in the States as it otherwise might. So I'm excited. I'm gonna get ready.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk about the Texas GOP convention. What is it? What are they talking about? And does it actually matter?
So, Jay, the Republicans have assembled in San Antonio this week for the 2018 convention. What do we take from this?
Sure. Well, if you've listened to the show for the last year and a half, which we hope you all have, you know that the one thing that you and I have talked about a lot on it is the fissure in the Republican Party, the battle between sort of movement conservatism, social conservatism, and what we call sort of Chamber of Commerce Republicans, kind of the traditional mainstream, I think kind of George H.W. Bush Republicans. Mm-hmm. And that's what you have here front and center. You have a continuation of this sort of battle going on. The current chairman, James Dickey, is sort of supported, came in at the 11th hour and was having to run for re-election here. His challenger, Cindy Ash, is making the argument that you have to appeal to minorities, to a broader constituency. We can't scare off moderates, so to speak.
This is why when Tom Melcher left and put Dickey in charge, he basically had the same message.
Right, exactly. And the problem you're having here is that Dickey, who is sort of this, supposed to be the unifying figure, a guy able to bring kind of some conservatives and moderates together, he's forced to move more to the right. He's still got problems on his right. And they continue to talk primarily about social issues, which I think is starting to cause greater tensions. Lots of conversation about the bathroom bill.
Yeah, the conservatives have taken to calling him Benedict Dickey because he apparently is turning his back on some groups. And this is the kind of civil war that's continuing. The question is whether or not they can unify against a kind of common enemy. Now, that enemy has been Joe Strauss, it's been Hillary Clinton, it's been Barack Obama. So they can find somebody, whether they're, you know, currently in office or not. Or was this the kind of thing that's going to pull the party apart? I'm not sure. On the platform, I think this is another big issue that is going to have to be resolved. This is really a kind of, literal, division that we're going to find as it comes to how they're going to put some of these specific party platforms together. To me, in this case, it's the dose that makes the poison. Some of these specific rules are toxic, I think, for the party in a general election, like the line to abolish abortion and to refuse to enforce any federal statute that deals with abortion. 83% of Texans in polling suggest that abortion should be available with various qualifications. There's also a line that says that homosexual behavior is, quote, contrary to fundamental truths. The polling I looked up from June of 2017 said 55% of Texans say gays and lesbians should have the right to marry. That's a majority. There's also a plank in there that says that Texas has the right to secede. Not that they will or could or should, but that they have the right to succeed. So to me, this is a kind of issue that needs to be resolved. And although this convention is supposed to bring people together, it's more likely to pull them apart.
Yeah. So we know the conventions by and large represent, the most committed and oftentimes sort of the most partisan members of each party. So we know that the Republican platform is going to represent, in many cases, the most conservative elements of that party, at least on an activist basis. I think what brings out more of a concern for the long-term prospects for Republicans is that they seem to want to exclude large chunks of existing Republicans. Mm-hmm. Now, you've, I think, rightly made this point in the media not too long ago that we saw a similar thing happen to Democrats sort of from the 70s on, and it's resulted in what we now see as a modern Republican Party that dominates. So we might be seeing the cusp of something more fundamental where moderate Republicans are going to flee the Republican mm-hmm. Party.
The other factor that really caused the breakup of the Democrats in the 70s and 80s was that they were reacting to what was happening at the national level. So they were really reacting to, the conservatives in the party were reacting to kind of more liberal changes at the national level. So one big question here that I think will be unspoken in most cases, or perhaps spoken in some hushed tones, is what to do about Donald Trump, right? He is somewhat popular in Texas generally. He's very popular amongst Republicans, but that could change fairly quickly. So the ways that they deal with Trump and how they kind of skirt or embrace the politics of Donald Trump, I think are going to tell us a lot about where the party's going to go in 2020, as well as in this upcoming election.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you why this convention actually matters.
So, Jay, the convention is going on this weekend. There's a lot that's going on. Why should we care about this?
Well, I think it's exactly what we were talking about earlier, which is there's a division in the Republican Party. To me, this convention represents that point where the Republicans are going to have to decide, are they going to be a big tent party or are they going to sort of double down on the conservatism or the brand of conservatism there they've been espousing the last few sessions. This might be sort of the beginning of the end of the Texas Republican Party as a majority party in Texas.
Mm. I think a couple things are worth noting here. I mean, number one is that the leadership that they choose here will affect the rules, and the rules will affect the outcome. So the conservatives are worried that they're basically getting outvoted. That's something that they can change here. We'll see if they're successful. The party needs to build a bench of candidates and issues that are going to appeal to a younger generation of Texans. The state will be more racially diverse, more ethnically diverse, and that's something that the party has to have if they're going to be a party in the majority, as you say, instead of a party in the minority. And finally, the platform is a big key here. So let's watch to see kind of what happens. This will serve as a purity test for primaries, not necessarily now, but into 2020. And that'll give us a flavor for kind of where politically the party is going to go.
That's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci. Special kudos to our web team, Giselle Bueno, Matt Pendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, Mr. Football, Hooslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.